We are Little Brown Women, and welcome to our podcast, Unplugged. Every fortnight, we talk candidly with our wondrous guests and with each other about a range of important and topical issues, often from the lens of identity, culture, and empowerment. Today, our guest is a freelance beauty editor and brand consultant, having previously worked at some of the UK's biggest magazines, such as Stylist and Marie Claire. She's also a published author and a powerful activist, focusing on race equality and the representation of black beauty and hair in the wider beauty industry. She is Ava Welsing-Kitcher. In today's episode, we explore Ava's life journey, how she came to be a beauty editor, what culture and identity means to her, and how she is actively changing stereotypical attitudes and assumptions about black beauty and hair. Her mission is to make the beauty industry more inclusive and representative of the diverse world we live in. Without further ado, let's get talking.
Welcome, Ava. We are so excited to have you on this podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for such a great introduction. I learned a lot of things about myself, such as I'm an activist now.
You are, and that, well, that's how we see you anyway. We think the work you do is fabulous, which is clearly the reason we wanted you on this podcast. So how have you been? How have you been keeping? What's new?
I've been good. I feel like I'm preparing to enter another way of working. Of course, we don't know what's going to happen with lockdown and stuff, but that's what's been on my mind lately.
I know, us too. It's weird, isn't it? I know we would have much preferred to actually record with you in person, but here we are, virtual working. Well, as we said in our introduction for you, we think you're just amazing, and you are very well known in the beauty industry for raising awareness around the representation of women in colour in the beauty industry in a variety of ways. And I think just to get the conversation started, we really wanted to know a little bit more about your life and your upbringing, and I guess what inspired you to become a beauty writer.
Yeah, so it's quite a funny one about how my upbringing plays into where I am now, because I am from London originally. But my mum kind of took us from London when I was starting to become a teenager and first moved us to Bournemouth. So I went from being in a very diverse, multicultural atmosphere where, to be honest with you, I didn't think about race or racism. I was still fairly young, I was about 10. And then when I entered into a very, let's say, heterogeneous kind of society, which is a small town, Bournemouth, it then made me start thinking about race. And my family is a mixed race family. My mum is a black mum. Me is a mixed race girl. It was pointed out to me very obviously. And then from then on, we then moved to Amsterdam and then to Lisbon. And I only came back to England when it was time to go to university. So I was put into so many different environments, which were different in a lot of ways, but they still remained the same as very white, and we still stuck out. So I didn't really see a lot of people around me in society that looked like me. I used to obsessively, you know, spend all my pocket money on all the magazines that came from America and from England. The prices were extortionate in Amsterdam and Portugal, but I bought them anyway to try and get an understanding of, you know, at this point, my love for beauty was blossoming, and I wanted to kind of see myself represented in magazines because I couldn't see it on the streets around me. I didn't see it at school. I wasn't seeing it on TV that much, and I still didn't get a very diverse representation. Sometimes I'd luck out and I'd get my hands on a copy of Essence, but that was it, and they were so rare that I didn't understand why they weren't in the 20 other choices of magazines that I could buy. So with that, I started to look online, and I found so many blogs created by black and mixed race women for us. I ended up becoming obsessed with YouTube, where women were taking the power into their own hands and creating content where, you know, these big corporations weren't always going to create content for us. And I learned everything I knew about beauty in terms of black women and taking care of myself and my hair and my skin on the internet. So it was a weird kind of dichotomy between two. So then when it came to going to university, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew that I was good at writing. I knew I was good at art, but I didn't want to be an artist because I didn't think I could make a living off that. So I knew I wanted to write. I didn't really know that you could be a beauty journalist. And to this day, it really makes me laugh because, I mean, I was reading all these magazines. I didn't think to check the masthead. I think I thought that if you worked at a magazine, it was going to be like the Devil Wears Prada. And you were going to have to write about everything. And the thought of writing about fashion made me really nervous because I was like, I don't know what this season was and who wore that season. Like, I just thought it seemed too intimidating. So for some reason, I was really like, I didn't look into that. I just put my head down. I put my head down towards finishing my degree and like partying with my friends. And I just don't know. It really flabbergasts me when I think of the fact that I didn't know that you could be a beauty journalist, but somehow I found out, and I then started directing all my efforts into doing that during the last year of university. And I feel like it all happened very quickly to the point where I don't remember what the steps were, but I remember contacting my auntie. She worked at Marie Claire at the time, and I told her what I wanted to do, and she said, well, you have to come in and do a 2-week internship. And at the time, I thought internships were like, you know, gold dust. I think from watching The Hills, I remember seeing like Lauren Conrad. But at the time, I was so grateful. And I spent 2 weeks at Marie Claire with the beauty team. I missed my own graduation because I was like, I don't want to miss any of this internship. And then it all started from there. I went in not knowing who were in the industry. I didn't know who anyone was in the industry because I feel like I've been under a rock for so long. I think it makes me laugh when I speak to like my fellow like beauty editors and beauty journalists, because they've been following people's careers for such a long time because they've known what they wanted to do. And I've really envied that because I haven't had that same kind of intel. I think during the age where people start to follow, you know, beauty journalists started to get a real following on Instagram, I think a lot of people were introduced to the world through that. Somehow not me. So it does make me laugh when people ask me how. I feel like I just kind of fell into it, but actually it's what I wanted to do all my life. Like, it just made perfect sense. Like, my two passions, beauty and writing, coming into one. Like, yeah, all I had to do was Google. And it would have been so much quicker and easier.
You know what? It's so interesting hearing about your journey to finally becoming a beauty editor. And I think it's really nice because it seems so personal, and it seems like it was just almost, it almost bloomed from this seed from when you were so young. Mm. And all of these different elements, you know, you not having people to relate to. And then obviously loving the magazines that you invested all your probably pocket money in, but yeah, absolutely just falling in love with this sort of, I guess it was sort of a portal to that world, because apart from that, where else would you have seen it? That was the mainstream element of it, the magazines. And I think from what you said, it almost feels like the accessibility wasn't there for you. And I think between Kay, Dami and I, we probably really relate to you in that. I think on one hand, because we are women of color, you know, for some reason, it just feels like careers and professions are slightly more inaccessible to us because the resources just aren't there. People aren't kind of choosing us to nurture and be like, yes, you're the ones that are going to be the leaders in those professions. And, you know, sadly, it is probably racial prejudice, but that's the world we live in. And I think we've all had that lived experience. But I guess I love the way that you, despite all of that, to me, it almost feels like you manifested your profession. and it like through all of those life experiences, you almost just didn't fall into it. It actually happened because you were subconsciously so focused on being that. And I love the fact that you wanted to be a living representation for women of color. And I know that we'll get onto this later, but we absolutely adore your work that you do to raise, we love the work that you do to raise awareness of Black beauty in particular. And, you know, I guess we, as Little Brown Women, we have our logo there, and we actively chose that logo because it shows the shades of brown. It's not just one, it's not just one shade. And I'm sure that you'll agree, but you know, 10 years ago, finding foundation colors that suited you and finding models that you could think, wow, yeah, you know, I relate to that, you know, I feel beautiful because I see a representation that's similar to me, that just wasn't there. And I think it is becoming more mainstream now, but as you said, you, when you were starting out, you found everything on other platforms rather than in mainstream magazines. And I guess you're almost kind of doing that now, you're using those platforms and making it accessible. And I mean, we just think that's fantastic.
Thank you. I don't think it was such a strong intention to try and make change, because honestly, at that age and at that point, I didn't think of myself in that way. I didn't think I had that kind of power. It just so happened that a lot of the articles I would pitch would be for women like me and for other women. And it just, I think as each place I worked at, as you know, it would be a funny kind of dance. Either they'd respond to it really positively or they just would ignore it. And I think I've been really blessed to have worked at places like Stylus, which really have listened to me when I've wanted to pitch diverse content because it is their brand. And I think being given that, not just a nod of approval, but, you know, a round of applause of approval, really boosted my confidence and made me feel like this is something I think when you're entering a workplace as a black or brown woman and no one around there looks like you, it can be so difficult to put yourself forward and even just pitch ideas that you know to a room of people that you know nothing about the topic. It can be really difficult, especially when you're young. And I think having that encouragement quite early on in my career really bolstered me and made me feel like the topics I want to write are important, not just for the women I'm writing them for, but for the room of people I'm pitching it to. Seeing people be so actively engaged and want to learn more about the topic, even though it has nothing, like they don't have afro hair, they don't have black skin, but they still want to know, or they don't, you know, things like halal beauty, like they don't relate to that, but they still want to know. It's just so, yeah, I think that's really important. I think that's where a lot of different places get it wrong without realizing, like, if you really want to be not just diverse but actually representative, because there's such distinction between the words, you have to make your employees of color feel, not just feel seen and heard, but feel actively supported. Like, you have to be the supportive mechanism underneath them, because it's going to be you opening the doors. I think a lot of publications and companies think we've ticked the box by having 5% of our workforce are not white. That's where their work ends. And I've been in that situation before. It's not where the work ends. You have to make those people who are showing up every day to a workforce that doesn't look anything like them, doesn't share a lot of cultural similarities, have very different upbringings, and you need to make them feel supported when they are putting themselves kind of in the line of fire, because we don't know what safe spaces are. It's that we have to put ourselves out there and expose ourselves in order to find out. And I think a lot of places do not. Even they've never had to consider that from their position of privilege. So really what the past few months have shown us is that you have to do the work and be more, that's how you actually become an ally.
I couldn't agree more.
Ava, that was fantastic what you shared about your childhood experiences, and it's definitely influenced how you've bloomed into the beauty industry. It's just fascinating, especially with your upbringing and, you know, the relationship that you had with your mum, and how she's guided you through this windy path within the beauty industry. And so I guess, how has working in the industry, the beauty industry today, fueled you to explore your own identity and your culture, and being the powerful activist that you are, today to make beauty more inclusive?
I really think that things started to kind of grow the most when, like I mentioned before, when you're in a place where your ideas are completely validated and celebrated. I think I really have been in positions, you know, not just at the start of my career. There's so many microaggressions that I face, that I've seen, you know, other people face, other employees. And I think that what has really made me think very deeply about me and my position within the industry is the fact that often when I've come in to a beauty team, I've been, not all the time, but most of the time, I've been the only person of colour. And I think realising, you know, realising the kind of content that people have wanted me to write, which, you know, at the time I've been very grateful for. And now I've got to the point where I can see clearly that times where I was kind of expected maybe or hoped to be, you know, what's the word? Not the voice of all blackness, but the ambassador, the brand ambassador for blackness, to help people to reach a black audience. And it's been really frustrating me because I feel like a lot of people see, like, oh, we're writing for women of colour, or they divide that further. We're writing for black women, or we're writing for South Asian women, or they divide that. Or that's where it stops, actually. I think that look how many magazines and newspapers we have for different types of white people. We have the career guest, we have the career, like, woman, we have the jet setter, we have the young student activists, we have the ones who are at home, you know, work it at home, stay at home mom with their kids, and they're watching daytime TV. Like, I've written for all of those kinds of women. But then when it comes to black women, it's like we're all lumped into the same category, as if one article on foundations that do 40 plus shades is going to make every black woman jump for joy. Because it's not. I feel like that, I don't think we've always been appreciated as being so multifaceted. We're from completely different parts of the world. We have and I think that I didn't realize that they were doing that until I was being asked to write articles, which just made it clear that they didn't understand my position within blackness. I was asked to write an article on skin lightening, my experience with skin lightening, and I was like, oh my god, do they realize I'm mixed race? Do they think that I've lightened my skin? And then when I kind of said, oh, I don't think that would be right for me because I don't have any experience with skin lightening, no one in my family does at all.
My jaw has dropped.
Were shocked. I remember them being so shocked that no one in my family lightened their skin. And I was just like, I was just remember thinking, you've obviously realized this was a thing. You probably stumbled upon a first person piece, or you saw a documentary about it, and now this is like your new thing, and you really want your magazine to write about it. So you've picked the only non-white person, and you're confused. Like, do you not? And also, what if I did lighten my skin? Do you know how triggering that is to be asked by someone that you work with to write an article about it? I feel like journalists on a whole are really mined for our, and a lot of the time we do offer it up freely, but we are mined for our personal highs and lows and trauma to make good first person pieces, because it is what people relate to. We want people to feel seen, and it is really empowering to write a great first person piece. But when you're a person of colour, that increases tenfold. I mean, it's just the amount of times that I've seen someone else in my office or myself be approached to write our take on a topic which is going viral, such as like Solange's amazing braids being edited out of her cover, or Lupita's ponytail being edited out, things like that. And then it's just actually so funny how, you know, at the time everyone was swarming looking for like their brown representative to write a first person piece about it. And I always see these kind of pieces coming out, and it's just like, that in itself is a microaggression, because unless your black or brown employee has approached you saying, I want to write a piece about this, please don't approach them. That's all I can say, because, you know, it doesn't have to be every day mining ourselves for our emotional trauma and all our racial trauma. It's just very intense. That's one kind of microaggression. Another microaggression is misnamed so many times, whether it's the other mixed race girl in the office or it's the other black girl in the office. When I picked someone up on it for calling me very politely, I was still like very new at the job. I think I said my name, my name's not XYZ. And this person, he actually said, oh, but you guys, you know, you're the same height, same voice. And I was just thinking, but you don't see that. You're literally narrowing us down to the way we look, the way we sound. You're not even realizing the fact that we have completely different hair textures. We have completely different faces. We dress completely differently. Like, that is one of the things which people haven't realized is actually a microaggression. And I think it's often well-meaning people who think that they are fairly racially aware, quite left-wing, still do it, and they think it's a joke. I think, like, how many times have you been misnamed as the other brown girl in the office, and when you confront it, you're met with laughter or, oh, as if it's a joke, and it makes you feel stupid for getting upset. It's happened to you, right?
Oh, it definitely has. it's scary how common that is, Ava. It actually happened to me a year ago. I was walking from quite a distance, and it was an individual that just called out, "Hi, Priya." You know, that's just so demeaning. Just because I'm brown, you're just associating that I'm that one person that you know. You know, my skin tone doesn't define me. It's a part of me.
Exactly.
And I think it's just the same thing. It's the lack of awareness. And why don't people realize that that's just such a demoralizing thing to do? Of course, yes, you're welcomed with a joke. Oh, sorry, I didn't realize that you were Dami. You just look so alike. No, we don't.
No,
you don't at all. Actually, the other day, actually, I went to a restaurant and I made a reservation under my name. So my name is Damianthi. So it's a Sri Lankan name, and Sri Lankan names tend to have really a lot of letters in the name. And the guy welcomed me in, and he had reservations, multiple reservations, at around a 7:30 time. And he's never met me before, and he looked at me straight away saying, You're this person, aren't you? And I said, How did you know that I was that person? Well, I mean, you're obviously the person where I can't even pronounce the name, so.
Oh my god.
So I'm just holding myself in grace. Just laughing at me.
It's that kind of, it's so blasé, because I think people think it's justified. And I think that man was probably even proud of himself that he made that connection. I think that's what people have realized in the past few months with the uprising of Black Lives Matter, and people are having to actually take a look at themselves and their daily actions, and that they're, I call it lemon and herb racism, because even though it's not grabbing your attention like with the spice straight away, oh my god, this analogy, it still has a impact. It's low on the scale, but it has an impact, and it is having an effect, and people have had to look at themselves at all these little microaggressions and times where they've been racially insensitive and may not have realized it. And you know, it's your privilege which is stopping you from realizing it. That's the only thing, because it's everywhere, and the people who it's directed towards, intentionally or unintentionally, are realizing it. And I think it's so hard, because so much gaslighting goes on with this kind of racism, where just because your intention wasn't to be racist doesn't mean that it's not coming across as that.
It is like a level of accountability. We are now living in times where you're almost responsible for understanding what's right and what's wrong. The world's changing. People need to keep up with it now. And people need to understand what diversity and inclusion actually means. You know?
For sure. It takes a good long look at yourself and getting past that first layer of defensiveness before you then are able to actually do the work, because we all have privileges in different ways. The way that I see my privilege as a mixed race woman, I at first had slight shred of defensiveness where I would then think the same, and I realized I was thinking the same thing that certain white people would think. It's like, oh, but not all mixed race people feel that way, and not all mixed race people are like that. I'm not like that. And I thought I had to just be like, okay, this is what we have a problem with when it comes to white people saying it. So it's that first layer of defensiveness. And then once you work on getting rid of that, then you can see things clearly for what they are. And I think a lot of people need to get to that point. And I've seen people getting to that point. I've seen people, and I've challenged them about stuff, get super, super defensive. And then after a couple of days, we then can have a talk person to person.
I think if we're all ready to be open to hear and to learn people's thoughts and opinions, then we're going to be okay. I think it's the fear and the courage that we all need to bolster up, that if someone does or says something that is out of line, that we are able to address that in an open-hearted way with good intentions that are clear, to address and essentially re-educate them. And I think that's our responsibility, you know, as women of colour and us going through these times as we are today.
For sure. And there's also a time where we just have to take the time for ourselves. Like, the past few months have been very exhausting when it comes to having discussions about race with certain people. And there's got to be a point where you just clock out and you're like, you know what? I'm not doing this today, this week, this month, this year, this lifetime. And it's completely up to you. Like, if you want to educate and you have the reserves of energy to do that, then absolutely. And if you don't, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And it's going to ebb and flow between the two a lot, in my experience. And like, the way I feel right now, I don't really feel comfortable talking about race unless I'm with other people who have experienced racism. And that's the way I feel right now at this point in time, because there's been too much that's been going on where, you know, like, it's just, you have to just listen to yourself at the end of the day and uphold the people who, if you don't want to educate, uphold the people who are educating others and point people towards them.
Being part of a supportive network, and I think it's great. So, you know, with all these incidents that are happening today, and it's definitely made you more aware, and you know, I think it's great that you're talking about it and challenging it in the most open-hearted way possible. I think it's fantastic, Ava.
Your insight actually is really great. I know you're sort of mentioning how diversity is something that's chosen in a weird way with many businesses, and, you know, not just in your industry, Ava, even the industries that we're in as well. It's not just about promoting diversity. It's, you know, making people feel inclusive. And the fact that you're raising awareness for that internally and externally on various different topics in the way in which that you know best and you know how to, I think is really inspiring for us as well, because we are the era that grew up not having role models that we could aspire to be and know that there was opportunity and other routes other than, you know, typically we're from an Asian background, so it's either engineer, doctor, or or lawyer. But what I wanted to ask is, what really encouraged you to focus your practice on raising awareness around sort of black hair, what you're currently doing at the moment to raise awareness and challenge the status quo? What would you like to make sure other people are raising awareness around or understanding?
The way I've always seen it is that a lot of publications will do a one-off article maybe once or twice a year that will focus, for example, on black hair. And I think now that those kind of pieces are multiplying more and more, I think that the next step is actually embedding them properly, embedding black and brown women properly into your content rather than a few pieces here and there. In an ideal world, this would start with the team, but they're not, like, places aren't there yet. There are so few black beauty journalists that black beauty journalists and PRs that we've all become best friends, because there are not that many of us, and we are often the one black or mixed person in our entire team. So it really starts with teams. I know those are seeds that have to be planted, but there's so much amazing young talent just waiting to be hired. So I feel like that is the biggest thing. When it comes to content, you know, a lot of places are sort of, you know, hiring freelancers and commissioning a lot more of a diverse pool of voices. But, you know, that's a one-off thing here and there. Like, I think a lot of places need to actively invest in voices as people. BCPR, I think that an amazing example is a couple of agencies are actually investing a lot of money into mentorship programs. My friend runs a PR mentoring group for young black girls, and she's had so much overwhelming support. She's had brands and PR companies come in and work with her. They're doing amazing workshops, they're offering girls jobs, they're coaching them through everything. That's the kind of real change that needs to happen, because we do put a lot of focus on articles and things like that, but I want to know what is going on in the background. What schemes are you putting in place? What opportunities are you giving, rather than, because, you know, commissioning someone to write an article about, you know, their natural hair journey is great for the person, but it's also mutually beneficial. Like, you're going to get more clicks, you're going to get more people reading, and also that's going to kind of add to cementing your identity as, like, a diverse publication. So it is benefiting you in some way. I want to know what kind of work you're doing that you're not shouting about, that doesn't benefit you in as much as a way that it benefits the recipient. Anyway,
I just want to also say before you go sort of go on into it a little bit more detail, and it's, you know, it's the black community really opens its doors to the brown community in many ways as well. And I think, you know, things that you've mentioned over the course of a conversation, such as, you know, like foundation colours and even hair, just, I learned myself hair care through watching black influencers, through watching, reading about black articles, because, you know, in this culture, in this modern culture that we're living in, it is more relatable to look up to, you know, the black community and their experiences, because you are so similar to us in more ways than we know. So yeah, I really, really agree with you. Having, not just picking and choosing when you want to have a diverse team, or when you want to have a diverse statement, or if, you know, Black Lives Matter is being promoted more now than it was previously, to now have more black faces or brown faces, I think that needs to be done irrespective. And I very much agree with you on that one.
Absolutely. And I think I was lucky enough to, you know, be part of quite a diverse beauty team at Stylist in the beginning. And like Hannah on that team, it was just so supportive. It's such a supportive and nurturing environment to be able to bounce ideas off of Hannah before going into a meeting, or to say, what's your experience with this? Do you think doing this? Even things like, we did a beauty issue all together, and it was everyone's first beauty issue. We were really nervous, and we did a shoot on diverse foundation colors, and we did like the lightest of the lightest of foundations to the darkest of the darkest, and they kind of were all in the line. And then at the last minute, Hannah was like, we should shoot them the other way around, because whenever I go onto e-retailers and stuff and look at foundation, they always start from lightest to dark. She's like, let's put it from darkest to light. And even just having that input is like so important, because it just showed me that through working together on the things which we commonly face and uniting on them, it's such a small example, but for me it was really magical that happened. Because, and so many people come to me like, we love how you've done it from dark to light, and it's like, Hannah, like, it's because of you. Because she, it just makes me think of how much we could achieve, and we are achieving, because it is happening more and more now, for sure.
I really, really agree with you on that. And I just love that people like you and people like Hannah are really pushing that, and really, you know, you're advocating that on in various different ways. And, you know, the hope is that the future generation will see that there's opportunities like being a brand consultant or being a journalist, or, you know, to really follow your creative path. And I think that will really help in sort of cultural development for the future. I definitely agree with you in that forefront. Yeah, would you say there was any situation or circumstance that you have been in where you've really felt that, you know, your internal fire for something has been tested, or people have tried to put it out because you're trying to advocate something that's not the norm?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it depends who is on the other end of the receiving line. I think whatever I do, whatever message I'm trying to get across, I'm always going to be very respectful about it. And I think there have definitely been times where I've pointed out that something's cultural appropriation, and then that ability to point that out has kind of been taken from me, it's been invalidated. Or I think cultural appropriation is one of the things which people still don't get, really. So I feel like then putting that into a beauty context, it becomes really messy, because what are the biggest things of cultural appropriation when it comes to Black culture? It's hair. It's, you know, blackfishing, wearing foundation shades which are way too dark for you. Yeah, it's quite hard. I think that there have been times where I've pitched ideas and they've just fallen by the wayside, haven't been commented upon. Or there have been times where I've written a an opinion piece which maybe might be a bit more challenging. Or I've edited work, or I've put something forward. I've worked with someone on my team on a piece, and it's been labeled as, you know, angry. It's been said that, oh, it feels like you're like shouting at me with this paragraph, just because we're talking about a lot of the issues surrounding Black hair and about, you know, the boundaries that are crossed. And I feel like it's very rare that it's happened. That's how I know. Like, if I went to every single job and I was painted as overly challenging or aggressive or maybe having a bit of an attitude problem, if it was happening everywhere, then I'd be like, okay, maybe I am a problem, but it hasn't happened everywhere. It's happened extremely rarely, and never at more than one place. So, and I've seen it happen to other employees. So I feel like when you are a young Black girl in the office, preconceived notions of what it is to be a young Black girl are placed on you. And I think it's always so blatantly obvious when it happens what is actually going on. So that, I feel, lights my fire more, because in an ideal world, within the bubble of London, within the bubble of our place of work, if your ideas are constantly supported and celebrated, that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But the thing which gets my fire going in a different kind of way is when I met with opposition, and when I know it's unfair opposition. And I feel like everyone does go through that, and it can either really diminish your confidence, and it really does, or it can help you see the areas which things are not gonna fly. And that's every experience I've had where I've come up against opposition when it comes to race I've thought, how can I take this and make it into something so that it benefits me and benefits everyone else like me? And that's what I try and do every time. Turn it into something fruitful for us, I feel.
So beautifully put. And I think it's so, you put it really well to give people who don't understand a clear perspective. So hopefully there's someone out there that, you know, that doesn't quite understand why we feel the way we feel and why we are the way we are and why we approach situations in various different ways. But hopefully, you know, your insight will give our listeners and perhaps even the next generation just some perspective on, if you are going through these things, you're not alone. This is how we've overcome it. This is how we're using it to empower ourselves. So that was, yeah, that was really, really lovely, Ava. One of our key parts of being little brown women is empowerment. We want to empower people like me, people like yourselves, the younger generation, the generation before us, to know that we're all in this together and we're all going to come out of it together in a much, much better way. And, you know, if we join forces and empower each other, we're going to do that much more quickly. So, you know, it wouldn't be right if I didn't ask you, what does empowerment mean to you? And what do you do to empower yourself?
I mean, you could have asked me this like a few months ago and I would have had a very different answer. But I think right now empowerment means growth. It means looking back at who you've been before. And maybe occasions where you haven't been very proud of yourself or you have been, and knowing, using those moments to now equip yourself with what you need to become your next version of yourself. I think growth is something which so many people try and rush through it, but it is the most empowering thing, because the journey of learning from your mistakes, there's nothing more empowering. Like, you're faced with all facets of yourself and knowing what you, it's just, for me, it's the, I'm going through a very intense growth period right now, and I think that I'm very grateful for it, because I'm being shown parts of myself and sides of myself which no longer serve me. I'm trying not to use like very, like, you know, the speak, everyone always says your shadow self, and, you know, leave behind what no longer serves you. But those, they choose those kind of phrases, however overused they may be, for a reason, because how are you going to empower other people if you cannot feel empowered yourself? And growth is such a huge part of that, because I feel the most empowered when I'm helping other people grow in ways which might not even be a centered effort, but I think it becomes such a nice web of empowerment when everyone is focused on their own growth journey to then help other people grow.
That was so beautifully put, Ava. That was really, really lovely. Great insight just for everyone. That was really empowering, even for myself. Just, if you can't empower yourself, how do you expect to grow? And growth is something that is so important. That's it for today, guys. We'll be welcoming more great guests over the next few months, so stay tuned. In the meantime, follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter to keep up with all things LBW. And don't forget to like, follow, and leave a comment. Until then, don't forget to sign up to our monthly LBW newsletter via our Instagram page and follow us on all social media platforms. Until next time, take care and remember, live big and be kind to yourself.